All right, if people could take their seats, I think we're about ready to begin. My name is Clark Murdoch. I'm the director of the Project on Nuclear Issues here. I was also a proud participant in the first Pony Debates the Issues event and have been assigned a role as sort of just retribution for my participation last time, in which I did not recognize time limits. I ignored Jessica when she tried to get me to ask questions as opposed to making declaratory statements. And so my role in this one, other than making a very brief introduction to start us off, is that I have a timer. And that during the opening period, when people are making their opening statements and they have 7 to 8 minutes for that, I will stand when the 8 minute point has been reached, so the people understand they've got 30 seconds to wind it up. And we'll just try to get through that portion of it a little bit sooner so that we can get to questions and answers from the crowd as well. But I know that these gentlemen will be much more self-disciplined than I was, and I won't have to stand up at all because of their sense of timing. It's with great pleasure that I introduce to you, first of all, Jessica. She is my research assistant. She is a former Bill Taylor debate intern, and is the genesis of the Bill is the sort of the genesis of this debate format for this particular event, which I think you'll find quite entertaining and useful. Introduce first George Perkovich, who's taking the affirmative today on the question that we've asked, which I remind people is: the Obama administration should make the global zero vision of a world free of nuclear weapons a central focus of its foreign policy. Of course, we did that before the Obama administration did actually make it, so, in the Prague speech. But that doesn't mean we still can't debate the wisdom of the presidential decision to make this vision a centerpiece of its foreign policy. Anyway, George Perkovich, who I have recently come to know, participated in another CSIS-hosted event recently. He's Vice President for Studies and Director of the Nonproliferation Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of the award-winning book on India's nuclear bomb, but he has been at the core of the recent work that has been funded by the British government through the International Institute for Strategic Studies on how do you go about achieving this vision of a world free of nuclear weapons. Also delighted to welcome Ambassador J.D. Crouch, former Assistant Secretary in the Department of Defense, former Deputy National Security Advisor, a deep and original thinker on matters nuclear, from a somewhat different perspective than that of George Perkovich, and I think an admiral opponent on this particular debate. Jessica, I turn it to you.
I want to briefly acknowledge Chris Jones, who deserves all the credit for coordinating this the event tonight and making it happen. I just hogged the mic, but he also did half of it while abroad in London planning a trilateral U.S.-UK.-French nuclear dialogue, and he is the face behind the Pony Debates the Issues blog. We're very glad that he's been able to make everything happen so seamlessly. I'm glad that Clark clarified the topic, and we're really lucky that both of our debaters tonight agreed that the value of debating, or the intellectual value of having a debate on the desirability of the vision of a world without nuclear weapons is good, regardless of whether of how you interpret what Obama has said. So that's sort of the terms of the debate, even though traditionally the affirmative defends a change from the status quo, and there was sort of a heated debate internally about whether Obama's statements mean that is the topic is the status quo or not. The format for the debate is sort of a blend of traditional policy debate and presidential-style debates that we experimented with last time, and it worked, so hopefully it works for this debate as well. It'll begin with, we said 5 to 7 minutes, and I think Clark's going to jump up and down in 8 minutes, but remarks by Dr. Perkovich for the opening remarks, and then 5 minutes of a question and answer period following that, in which Ambassador Crouch asks Dr. Perkovich questions, and then that will be inverse for the negative. The negative will give 5 to 7 minute opening remarks, and then a question and answer period. And then Based on the substance of the debate, I'll ask a series of questions, I think three or four last time, and they will each respond to that question, and then we'll open it up to audience Q&A. So, Dr. Perkovich.
Thanks, Jessica, and thanks, Clark, and thank all of you for coming. Sir Lawrence Friedman, one of the world's leading analysts of nuclear deterrence and hardly a dove, offers, I think, the most succinct argument I know for the proposition before us tonight. He did this in an essay in this book, I'm putting a little plug, that James Acton and I have just released at Carnegie with 17 essays critiquing an Adelphi paper we have written on abolishing nuclear weapons. And in that, Sir Lawrence says, the case for abolition is that it is hard to believe that the past 60 years of self-restraint can continue for the next 60 years. I would say without a major change, more actors are likely to acquire nuclear weapons. Each new actor will threaten one or more current possessors of nuclear weapons. So the number of competitor nuclear relationships will grow exponentially. And with this proliferation of competitive relationships, risk will rise. This is far from what we now remember as the good old stable days of U.S.-Soviet deterrence. The risks of a world with more and more actors wielding nuclear weapons outweigh whatever benefits we have imputed to these weapons in the past. Indeed, as Henry Kissinger has come to realize and wrote last month, I believe, in the International Herald Tribune, these benefits have been greatly exaggerated. Kissinger writes, "The basic dilemma of the nuclear age has been with us since Hiroshima. How to bring the destructiveness of modern weapons into some moral or political relationship with the objectives that are being pursued. Any use," he writes, "of nuclear weapons is certain to involve a level of casualties and devastation out of proportion to foreseeable foreign policy objectives. Efforts to develop a more nuanced application have never succeeded." I think precisely because of the taboo that has grown against using nuclear weapons, it has become tempting to assume that these absolute weapons of mass destruction will not be used, and to forget what would be happen if they were used. Yet nuclear deterrence is predicated on the possibility that it will fail, that the weapons would be used. If this were not a real possibility, then nuclear deterrence would not work. The primary reason, then, for trying to create the conditions for eliminating all nuclear arsenals is to remove as far as possible the risk that these singularly terrifying weapons will be used. Let me be clear, eliminating nuclear weapons is not an end in itself. The purpose is to secure the United States and the world from the only threat that can destroy whole cities, or indeed whole nations, in a single spasm of violence, whether it's intended or not. President Obama and other champions of creating a world without nuclear weapons are not naive. Henry Kissinger is not naive. Bill Perry is not naive. George Shultz is not naive. Sam Nunn is not naive. On the contrary, these exceptionally experienced, hard-headed statesmen understand that it would be naive to believe that nuclear weapons will not be used in the rest of history. If we do not make every effort to eliminate these weapons, more actors will acquire them. The risks of their being used will become intolerably high. Now, opponents of this proposition will deploy plenty of straw men to shoot at. So let's be clear about what President Obama is not claiming or not proposing. This is not a project to end all war, as welcome as that might be. Eliminating nuclear weapons does not depend on ending all war. The process of verifiable and enforceable abolition does depend on creating major changes, improvements in the security relationships among the states that now possess these weapons. These security improvements must also extend to relationships between states that the U.S. now protects, Japan, NATO allies, South Korea, and their adversaries. But we know from experience how this works. The process of arms reduction and nonproliferation successes also helps improve security relationships. The two processes, arms reduction and political confidence building, work hand in hand, step by step, in what is a co-evolutionary process. Indeed, this is what progress is. Thirdly, President Obama and other realistic advocates of nuclear abolition are not claiming that these weapons can be disinvented. No human creation can be disinvented. Civilization has nevertheless prohibited or dismantled artifacts deemed too dangerous, damaging, or morally objectionable to keep. There are CFCs from the ozone. We don't have mass-scale gas chambers anymore. These could be invented. People know how to make them, but society decided that was unacceptable and took the steps necessary to prohibit them. Lastly, no realistic advocate of nuclear abolition argues that the U.S. can or should unilaterally disarm. Rather, the purpose is to draw all nuclear-armed states into a process of mutual verifiable reductions leading toward zero. This means Russia, China, the UK, France, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. The US would not eliminate its nuclear arsenal unless and until everyone else did too. Nor will we or the other nuclear armed states eliminate our arsenals if the nonproliferation regime is not much more robust than it has thus far proven to be in Iran. To say this is to acknowledge how difficult the challenge is. The point is that the U.S. should be willing to provide leadership and determination to create the conditions necessary for all these states to join such a process. The man who succeeded General Eisenhower as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Andrew Goodpaster, summarized well the logic of the proposition before us tonight. Goodpaster said, "The United States should go as far and as fast toward zero nuclear weapons as everyone else is willing to go with us. If others are not willing to move with us, we will stop. But we should be prepared to provide the political, moral, technological, and security leadership necessary to invite others to join us in this process. To refuse, to say that the U.S. is not willing even to try to create a world without nuclear weapons, is to invite further proliferation, weaken our capacity to persuade and at times coerce others to work with us to reduce the dangers of nuclear terrorism, proliferation, and war as long as these weapons do exist." Thank you.
Also, very nice to be here and to have an opportunity to engage with my colleague George on I think a very important debate, and I appreciate your being here, George, and willingness to do this as well. So, you know, there are a lot of different arguments about this issue. When reduced to their essence, I think the main arguments, what's in it for America on the abolition argument is, number one, that America will be seen as a world leader if it sets this proposition out in nonproliferation. Number two, that rogue states, particularly the ones we're worried about, and whether you like the term or not, will be forced to give up their nuclear ambitions. And the world will be safer as a result of an abolitionist outcome, particularly from nuclear terrorism. Even if all the states, it seems to me, currently in possession of nuclear weapons would agree to eliminate them, and I think this is a very unlikely prospect, as I'll talk about later, the skills and materials to make a crude nuclear device will remain available. As you said, it can't be disinvented, especially in the world, I think, of increasing reliance on nuclear energy. The problem of nuclear terrorism is not one of many weapons. It's one of one crude weapon. It's a big problem. I agree it's a big problem, but it's not one that I think abolition can solve. The second objective contends that irresponsible states will somehow act responsibly in the face of moral suasion of the United States and the others that we lead. But these states do not accept the United States as a moral arbiter. They seek nuclear weapons to establish themselves as regional hegemons, to seek legitimacy in the eyes of their oppressed peoples, and to raise the stakes of outside intervention in their human rights-deprived societies. These reasons, I think, are immune to abolition. Does abolition best improve our nonproliferation image around the world? The audience for this public relations effort is diverse. The ones that will applaud, say Sweden and Austria, may not matter too much. The ones that we worry about, say Iran, Syria, and North Korea, will likely not care what we think. But the ones we protect, like Poland, the Baltics, the Middle Eastern allies, or Japan, could very well be unnerved. As Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, recently pointed out, these states, quote, continue to rely on our nuclear deterrent rather than develop their own. How do you balance these questionable benefits with the potential that abolition has to undermine the fundamental bargain of the nuclear era? That American nuclear weapons have prevented major war, strengthened our alliances, and persuaded other nations that they don't need the bomb to defend themselves.
Well, I think you've understandably listed the four major arguments, but I think they aren't actually arguments against the proposition before us tonight or the purpose that President Obama has laid out. Again, he's not talking about unilateral nuclear disarm. He's not talking about the United States giving up its nuclear arsenal in a vacuum when other changes haven't occurred. So let me take each of these points. Terrorism, you're right. Nuclear abolition in and of itself isn't going to get rid of terrorists. It could very much limit the capacity of terrorists to get the materials with which they would make nuclear weapons. The process or what would be required to persuade the U.S. and other states to eliminate their arsenals would be such a robust and comprehensive program to inventory all nuclear materials in whatever form, to monitor, to verify its location, which is precisely what we've been calling for to deal with nuclear terrorism, and which you've worked on when you were in the government. You know that nuclear terrorism is a materials problem on the supply side. Everything that would be required in what the president has proposed and what I'm proposing would move you closer to a direction of the kind of controls that you want over these materials that's needed to deal with that problem. And there's nothing in having the objective that makes the terrorism problem worse. So we're moving in the right direction with this objective. Secondly, as far as terrorism, I don't believe it would be argued that we somehow would need to, even if you had these kinds of controls, that you would need nuclear weapons to deter terrorists, because either they're not deterrable would be the argument, or even if they were, the capacity to and the likelihood of locating the targets and using nuclear weapons against those targets is very low for reasons that we can elaborate. So I think the terrorism argument actually becomes an argument to move in the direction the president is talking about, to get control over these materials. Secondly, I don't think the president is suggesting, I certainly wouldn't suggest, that the elimination of nuclear weapons by all states, not just the U.S., would in and of itself resolve the Iran and North Korea problems. Rather, those problems have to be resolved in the process before we would eliminate all our arsenals. And no one's arguing, I think, that our action would necessarily be morally suasive. The point is that we need the rest of the world, or at least major powers, to cooperate with us in pressing Iran and North Korea, in enforcing the rules that they're breaking, or possibly coercing them through sanctions or use of force. We can't do it effectively unilaterally. And to rally that support, it's been demonstrated that as long as there's a double standard and we appear to be defending our nuclear weapons forever and saying those guys can't have them, that doesn't work politically in the world out there. So as a political reality to isolate those states, we need this support. Finally, on the issue of what you said, well, they can't be disinvented. I acknowledge that. They can't be disinvented. And in fact, the residual know-how can actually be a deterrent. The idea, much like it is in Japan, Japan's neighbors kind of understand that if they were to mobilize a kind of conventional power that would be needed to somehow invade Japan, Japan has the capability to produce a nuclear weapon. That in itself is a deterrent. We would retain that knowledge, as would the other nuclear armed states, in a latent form. So in that kind of macro sense, for a long time there would be this recessed deterrent that's inherent in the knowledge. Finally, on extended deterrence, this is a very important point. And again, there's a conflation of arguments. The U.S. is not going to eliminate its nuclear weapons as long as Japan's potential adversaries have nuclear weapons, as long as Russia has nuclear weapons, as long as Iran is marching forward with a capability that alarms Turkey. So the context would be very changed in which you would actually imagine the elimination of these weapons. And in that time, there would have to be, as there will be this year, an engagement with our allies. The allies are nervous already. They were nervous when you guys were in government, and you certainly weren't talking about abolition. This is a genuine problem, as you've worked very hard on, that would absolutely be vital with the president's agenda, is sitting down with Turkey, sitting down with Poland, sitting down with Japan and saying, what are the threats on the horizon that we have to deal with? We're committed to your deterrent. How are we going to resolve those threats? I think when you do that, you find that, A, most of those threats aren't such that nuclear weapons would be the weapon of choice to deter them or to fight a war with. But B, if you can eliminate those nuclear threats, then we're in a different world where we're still having to provide extended deterrence, but through conventional or other means. And the threats that are out there are more like the threats that Estonia faced. They got shut down by cyber attack, possibly from Russia. Are we going to nuke Russia over cyber attack in Estonia? No. Talking about nuclear deterrence doesn't make Estonia very comfortable. The gas shutoff in Eastern Europe, it was a very real security threat to the lives of Europeans today. Again, nuclear NATO isn't a useful deterrent to that kind of threat. The things that Japan is worrying about in the future come from China's economic power more than anything else, the loss of standing or apparent loss of standing. The U.S. has to reassure our allies that we will continue to hold them in the highest regard and provide for their security. But the relevance of nuclear weapons in all of that, it seems to me, is greatly exaggerated in any practical sense. And certainly moving to eliminate these things over decades in no way creates this a priori sense that we would be abandoning extended deterrence.
Okay.
You
ready?
Now you want me to go do my statement?
Your statement.
Okay, great. Thank you. Good elaboration. So I take this abolitionist proposition seriously. It's not a feint. It's not a stratagem to try to get other people to get rid of their nuclear weapons so that we can hang on to ours. I don't think it's just a process, although when people talk about it, sometimes they tend to focus on the process
more than they focus on the outcome. Yet since the end of World War II, our security has rested uniquely, if uncomfortably, on nuclear deterrence. I think the burden of proof, therefore, is on the abolitionists that the world that they wish to create is achievable, that the risks of getting there are acceptable, and that the outcome is desirable. So I'd like to talk a little bit about each of these. What is the likelihood of success? Well, first of all, I think it's low. Others may say low to medium. Abolition is probably unverifiable. Cold War arms treaties were difficult enough to verify when both sides retained thousands of weapons. As President Reagan said, and he's often invoked in this debate these days, trust but verify. And in that world, a certain amount of trust could go along with verification as each side was comfortable that they would retain a deterrent. But a world without nuclear weapons would provide no such comfort. The standards for compliance and the intrusive nature of inspections would have to be exactingly high, so high that it's probably unlikely that even the United States, much less more secretive powers like Iran, North Korea, China, Russia, would be willing to submit to such a regime. So consider the risk of being wrong by even one weapon when all others had been eliminated. Second, success is unlikely because the goal is unrealistic. I would contend it has never happened in human history that a dominant military technology has been abolished by mutual consent of the parties. We have signed treaties, for example, banning chemical and biological weapons, but neither of those technologies had anywhere near the dominance of nuclear weapons, and we banned them confident, we thought, that their use could be deterred, at least among states. By what? The very nuclear weapons that some now seek to abolish. And still, the threat of CW and BW persists today. Nuclear weapons may be different, but we cannot ignore the hard fact that no civilization has successfully repudiated a dominant military technology and survived. Third, abolition is unlikely because it's unsustainable. The advantage gained by the nation that can break out swiftly from the abolition regime would be palpable. It would consign a ready-made advantage to a state that sought to remake the world order, gain regional dominance, or just protect itself from a conventionally superior neighbor. Because it is unsustainable, it may also be unstable. As countries hedge to retain or develop the capacity to produce nuclear weapons quickly and perhaps clandestinely. Today's world with acknowledged and unacknowledged nuclear powers is far from perfect, but it might be more stable than one in which irresistible advantage, mutual suspicion, and the drive for international prestige combined to create proto-nuclear states out of many that live happily today under the American nuclear umbrella. But what are the risks of trying? There must be something worth doing here. First, I would say, much of that abolitionist thinking assumes that the United States will continue to be a dominant conventional military power for the foreseeable future. This may be a good assumption. Even if it turns out to be true for a long time, I would point out it's not a birthright. How perishable is that American military prowess? It was not that long ago that the United States itself advocated a strategy based on nuclear escalation to deter a superior conventional Soviet military. Can we confidently predict that the United States will remain unchallenged conventionally forever? 10 years? 20? Second, even if we do manage to maintain that superiority, we cannot be indifferent to developments in the nuclear field that could provide a game-changing advantage to potential opponents. Now, abolitionists say, well, there won't be any game-changing advantage. But these advantages could well be constructed without our knowledge. Both Russia and China sustain vigorous nuclear development and deployment programs today, and they're mostly opaque to our understanding. Former Soviet First Deputy Prime Minister Sergei Ivanov boasted recently that, quote, new types of nuclear weapons are already emerging in Russia. And I would submit that non-democratic regimes will find it much easier to sustain publicly a call for nuclear abolition and at the same time maintain a vigorous nuclear research and development program than we will. Third, human history suggests, lamentably, that conflict and war are likely to remain a central feature of our existence. In the most recent history, say the last 400 years, we've witnessed a series of increasingly destructive and global struggles between states, culminating in the Second World War, in which over 70 million people perished. And then, global great power war ceased. Now, of course, there's no way to prove that nuclear weapons are the main reason we've successfully avoided global great power war, but it stands to reason that nuclear weapons have substantially raised the risks in such behavior. There is something different about nuclear weapons, and that difference has contributed to peace and most especially to the absence of global war. As the Strategic Posture Commission recently noted, getting to the goal of zero nuclear weapons will, quote, require a fundamental transformation of the world political order, unquote. Call me conservative because I want to see us get a little further along that transformative path before we commit to abolition. But isn't the risk of proliferation, as George pointed out, even greater? And I think the answer is yes. But in moving toward a nuclear-free world, we must find ways to get others to move with us. Paradoxically, American initiatives to abolish nuclear weapons may have the exact opposite effect. Today, a large number of our allies and friends depend on the American nuclear guarantee to assure their security. Some have explicitly eschewed nuclear weapons themselves because of that guarantee. And many of them do not primarily fear a nuclear attack, but conventional military means or other means. For these allies, the American nuclear umbrella and the connection that it symbolizes to American commitments to their country is the glue that binds Western security together. Moving toward abolition could be seen as breaking that fundamental bargain. Technologically advanced states could move to develop their own nuclear capabilities to compensate for this perceived withdrawal of the American guarantee. For if we ought to abolish nuclear weapons, how can we at the same time publicly maintain that they are central not only to our security, but to that of our friends and allies? The result could well be a spiraling proliferation in the Middle East, Asia, and even into Europe. Finally, and this is a point I think that is lost on some in the debate, but it's one that I was reminded of by my colleague here, that nuclear abolition vision in some ways can be very unproductive. Much common ground exists on the threats of nuclear terrorism, the need to strengthen the NPT regime, the need to control access to fissile material and other weapon technology, the need to support programs that help eliminate or safeguard nuclear weapons, the need to provide a viable alternative to the full fuel cycle for countries that pursue nuclear energy, the need to reduce our own stockpile as we sustain our deterrent, and so on. Most important, we have to find an effective response to the challenge of North Korea and Iran. But none of these objectives requires a commitment to abolition. And yet the debate over abolition divides us on these questions. It does not bring us together. It makes it harder to see the compromises that will be the stuff of a durable nuclear policy. I don't question the good intentions of those advocating nuclear abolition. I contend simply that setting a national goal, however visionary, that is likely unverifiable, unrealistic, unsustainable, unstable, potentially fraught with undesirable consequences, and politically unproductive, is not good policy. And doing so could well undercut our will to maintain our nuclear deterrent in the short run and devalues the roles of the individuals in whom we have vested that responsibility in the long run.
Well, I mean, if saying that the goal of a world without nuclear weapons would do all of those horrible things that Ambassador Crouch has outlined, I would say we shouldn't say it. But it doesn't look that way, and I don't think it's going to turn out that way either in the near term or the long term. The rest of the world, including our allies, are not saying, heaven forfend, the leader of the United States would like to have a world without nuclear weapons someday. I think, in fact, the response is very different, precisely because of the risk that doesn't appear at all in the arguments that Ambassador Crouch makes so well, which is the risk that actually nuclear weapons might go off. That's discounted entirely in the presentation, either today or in the future. And again, if you could tell me or anybody could tell me with any basis for high confidence that if we kept things the way they were, including the possession by the U.S. of nuclear weapons and the others, and you could give me high confidence that these things would never be used for the rest of history, I'd say let's go drink, because that's I welcome it, and I get an earlier dinner, and that would be fantastic. I think everybody here would say that would be fantastic. But it's precisely that we have doubt, and that the rest of the world has doubt, that the status quo or something resembling the status quo will actually prevent forever the use of nuclear weapons, that President Obama and others, Kissinger, Schultz, and so on, have put forward this goal. But no one's claiming, including the president, that we know that it can be done, that we know when it could be done. Rather, it's saying, let's try to get together with others and challenge ourselves and others to work on resolving these issues that you very aptly put forward, first of all. Secondly, when you speak of, again, the core, and I forget your exact words, but it was the core bargain that we have with our allies, which, as you put it, was a nuclear bargain with the allies to kind of keep our nuclear weapons and potentially use them in their defense. I don't dismiss that we have security agreements with the allies, but I think if you went and asked many of those countries, including leaders of Japan, what's the core nuclear bargain, they would give you a different answer. It would include there's a bargain to disarm, that there is a commitment already of all nuclear weapon states to eliminate their nuclear arsenals. So at least we got a couple of bargains that are in play here. But you know, you may say it's not just the one, and I accept that, it's not just the nonproliferation for disarmament bargain. But I would argue it's not just the extended nuclear deterrent bargain either. And that, again, is part of the reason to begin on this challenge that President Obama has laid out, which, and as you know very well from all of your experience, which in Japan and NATO states, they're of two minds. They want both. There is a strong position in Japan in favor of nuclear disarmament as well as the retention of the nuclear deterrent. But you can't wish away one or the other. I'm not wishing away the extended deterrent piece, but I'm saying we have to address that. But I also don't think that it's politically constructive to deny the other part of the bargain, which is a nuclear disarmament bargain. And I certainly know that you have this experience as well as others in this room, that when you go to Europe and you talk with NATO states, I mean, you can have multiple conversations with one German, I mean, about, you know, which
Monday,
is it?
Wednesday and Friday.
Right. I mean, and Saturday. Right. I mean, so it's not an either or. I mean, it seems to me that we need to pursue both and try to, you know, work on both, both gradients. I also think, and you invoked history, which is very important, and the post-World War II history and major powers and everything else. I think it would be foolish to deny that the U.S. and the Soviet Union, at least, did display a lot of restraint after World War II. And you rightly said causally, you can't say how much of that had to do with nuclear weapons. But let's say, I mean, it was there. I mean, it'd be foolish to say it wasn't there. I think it can be exaggerated. But you ignored the point that Kissinger makes, too, which is we never have been able to reconcile or bring into these weapons into a moral or political relationship with the objectives that we would seek in any crisis. And that's one of the reasons why there was a whole lot of self-deterrence when the United States had a nuclear monopoly between 45 and 49. A lot of bad things happened in Eastern Europe. We didn't use nuclear weapons. We didn't threaten to use nuclear weapons. There was a reason for that. In the 50s, in Korea and with Taiwan, again, we had a nuclear monopoly vis-a-vis the Chinese. We didn't use nuclear weapons. If you read the history, and I'm sure you have, but the presidential deliberations on this, the president said we can't use these weapons for precisely the reason that Kissinger adduced. And so if for a country like the United States, and again, you've sat in the Oval Office working. I've sat there but not working. You know, it's hard to imagine, right? The president, a situation where the president says, yes, let's launch. Now, you can imagine others may be doing that. So as long as others have these weapons, we will need a deterrent. But it's not a weapon of comparative advantage for a civilization like the United States, I would argue. And so that if you can get into a project, a process, where you could reduce others' possession of these weapons and perhaps eliminate it, that's to the United States' advantage, precisely because they're not very usable weapons. And I think that's the insight that the president is opening with. And by the way, again, no one would claim it'd be easy. One of the reasons it's going to be very hard is that when you talk to Russians and Chinese, I'm talking about officials with this proposition, they see it as a U.S. plot to take over the world with conventional weapons. So they see it as abolition absolutely in the U.S. advantage, and something I think that they're going to be very reluctant to follow upon. But even if that's true, then you don't get to zero. Seems to me having that objective is to the advantage of the United States, both politically and for diplomatic purposes, if the others think that actually you're playing to an advantage by seeking abolition. So again, I don't understand. I accept a lot of the arguments, but they're not arguments in my mind that weigh decisively against setting out on this objective.
Well, George, I've taken the view that setting out on an objective, you ought to sort of have a clear eye of what it's going to be like when you get there, right? And so I think a lot, as I said, a lot can be accomplished in terms of reducing mutually our arsenals. Frankly, in terms of our stockpile, reducing unilaterally our stockpile. We have way too many weapons in the stockpile. All these things can be done, as well as the very important set of steps that were outlined in the Gang of Four, or whatever you want to call them, op-eds that frankly are not connected to abolition in any way. You don't have to buy into the notion that that's the desirable outcome to take those steps. That's the reason I called it unproductive. I think it's divisive. I think it's going to be harder to get a political consensus in the center to take those tough decisions about our arsenal if doing that is against the backdrop of committing to that vision. Now, clearly, Article 6 of the NPT treaty says, you know, the parties undertake to pursue negotiations in good faith, you know, to on effective measures relating to the cessation of the nuclear arms race, et cetera, and on a treaty on general and complete disarmament, right? The notion is that, if I may put it somewhat cynically, when the lion lies down with the lamb, we'll be there, all right? My suggestion is there's still too many lions in the world, and I don't want to be a lamb. So if we look at the question of will nuclear weapons go off, I can't argue with you. I can't say I can say for absolutely certain that we won't have a nuclear use. But it's interesting. In the process of getting to abolition, you may well increase the likelihood of a nuclear use if, in fact, it increases instabilities. And so I, too, believe, and I believe that fundamentally these are political weapons. You fail when they're used. And as you know, Secretary Schlesinger likes to say, they're used every day. They're just not used in the sense that the weapon is detonated. They're used in the sense that they deter, they assure allies, they do those things. They have a political component to them that is extremely important in terms of advancing our national security goals. The NPT bargain, absolutely. We've got to find a way of striking that balance better. I do think there are things we can do reaching across the political divide in this country and with our allies on that. But I would submit to you, I don't think it requires a commitment to abolition. And it may well, and your point about the way the allies feel about this, different allies feel differently, no question about it. And even the same German can have a different attitude. But I have personally sensed that depending on how close you are to Russia or to North Korea or to China, those allies are getting particularly nervous these days. They were on our watch. I think they're very unnerved by what's going on now. So nuclear weapons are not a panacea for every problem. But while it may be okay for Russia to attack Estonia with cyber weapons, I don't want to see the day where it's okay for them to cross either the nuclear threshold or even the conventional threshold. And I do think nuclear weapons continue to play a role in that respect.
I wanted to go back to a comment you made earlier about retaining the residual know-how sort of as a deterrent. And I'm interested in specific proposals that you've thought about for retaining and advancing that know-how at the labs as we reduce to significantly lower numbers. And that know-how not only being the nuclear weapons themselves, but also all of the residual sort of make-for-work or work-for-others programs that are done at the labs and non-proliferation capabilities, verification capabilities that are leveraged off of that core strength of the nuclear weapons program. The demands on that cadre of sciences that maintain the or steward the arsenal increase as the stockpile shrinks. For example, at zero nuclear weapons, the hedge passes from the stockpile to the infrastructure entirely. You discuss this in your book, The Virtual Nuclear Arsenal. But the ability to recruit and retain those scientists gets extremely difficult when the country is on a path towards eventually putting them out of a career. And this is not any other job. This is nuclear physics. It's giving up 10 years of your life. And how specifically do you think we could energize and rejuvenate that scientific base of the labs while committed to that vision?
It's a great question. First of all, in the process of moving towards zero and getting towards zero, if the necessary conditions can be created, and we're not saying that we know that they can, but when you get there, the kind of hedge, implicit or explicit in the know-how, that will be a fact whether or not it's a desired policy. Unless you're going to do unspeakable things to the people around the world who have this knowledge, it's going to be a fact that would have to be managed in kind of designing the regime internationally to get to zero and beyond. In other words, the question would be, what do we do with the know-how? What do we do with labs? And it's not just ours. It's all the places where it exists. I don't have the expertise or knowledge to kind of lay out a plan of how you would do that. The point, and it doesn't matter, because the point would be that the states involved, all of whom have their labs and the same kind of concerns that we have here, they would have to address that. We would want to know what's happening with the Chinese labs. Where are, do you have a monitoring program for all of the people that you've identified have critical knowledge? Do you know where they are? Do we know where they are? They're going to want to know where ours are. And that's something that I think the governments and labs now should be thinking about. It's harmless to think about. And starting to do internal studies about how you would design for this challenge in a distant day. That said, because it's a fact, there is a latent deterrent piece of that, which again would have to be reckoned in any agreement for all of us to eliminate our weapons would be, kind of what happens if there is intelligence or warning that somebody is reconstituting or there's an activity or three Indian scientists who are designers have gone missing. They went on a vacation to Dubai and they didn't come back. That at least in the near term of an abolition process, that's going to be the kind of thing that you would have to wrestle with. On the recruiting and the retention part, yeah, I mean I know the argument, and I think it's a stronger argument today when we know we have an arsenal, we know we're going to have it for the foreseeable future. And you need to have the talent there to keep it safe and reliable. I understand it. It's a hard argument to make internationally, by the way, to states that don't have nuclear weapons. Is, wait a minute, we can't do this because how are we going to recruit really smart guys from MIT to build bombs? And they say, well, not really our problem, and it's kind of weird. But it's a legitimate interest. As you get, globally towards zero, it seems to me that it would be, a hard argument to make then internationally that the reason you can't do that is because the smart kids at MIT won't want to come and work in labs where there may be needing a reconstitution capability. It seems to me also that if the threat is out there to the U.S. or others, then it wouldn't be hard to motivate people to do it. And if there weren't a threat, then it wouldn't be as acute a problem as it seems to be today. But of all of the challenges in this agenda, if that's the deal breaker, so be it. But I think it would be hard to make that. One last thing is Ted Taylor was one of the best weapon designers that the U.S. had, I'm told. I mean, he didn't tell me, but other people said that he was really good. And he used to talk about this because he became an abolitionist. And he'd say, look, the B-61, he says, I can do a videotape, he said, and any sophomore in physics with my instructions can build that bomb, and you could do anything to that thing, and it won't go off when it's not supposed to, and I can guarantee it will go off when it's supposed to. Now, I'm not in a position to evaluate that argument, but if we're talking about all of the experience that we have in the labs, and the capacity to pass on knowledge, it seems to me that that's not an insurmountable hurdle. It shouldn't be the final argument against this project.
Do you have a response, sir?
Well, a couple thoughts. I think, if you look at the international landscape and the impact that we're trying to have on people, obviously, I mentioned the allies that I'm concerned about, and I also mentioned the rogues, which I think are going to be very unlikely to care very much. I accept the point that, to some degree, that, well, what we're really trying to do, it's a bank shot, right? We're trying to get the international community, to the degree that that's not an oxymoron, to put pressure with us on these states and to try to get them to move in the direction of either putting their programs under, in the case of Iran, putting them under IEA inspection, or in the case of North Korea, to essentially disestablish them, right? The problem, it seems to me, is that I don't think that, again, with the exception maybe of Austria and Sweden, who, again, the rogues don't tend to listen to, there's not going to be much impact from that. And indeed, many states are going to continue to view this through the prism of their own narrow interests. I don't think Iran really... India really cares that much whether Iran has nuclear weapons. I think it probably would wish that it didn't, right? But on the other hand, it cares a lot more about selling gasoline to Iran, or it cares a lot more about its trade with Iran. So basically, the dominant feature of those relationships is going to continue to be what they are today. On the knowledge point, look, we're having a hard time, I think, sustaining. You know, we have a consensus out of the Perry Schlesinger Commission that says, you know, for the foreseeable future, for the indefinite period of time, we need a nuclear deterrent. We're going to have a hard time sustaining the capability to do that in terms of our scientists over the next 15 or 20 years without positing a moral abolitionist argument against weapons. I think it's going to be harder. How much harder? It's difficult to say. But, you know, there are men and women who are out there every day, not only in the labs, but the ones who are sitting watch in missile silos, sitting watch in bombers, out in submarines, whatever, who are increasingly believing that what they're doing is not important for the country. Maybe the argument, your argument is it's not important for the country, but other people are saying it is important for the country, and I don't think you can sustain that over a long period of time, particularly with the leader of our country arguing that we have a moral obligation to do this. Now, absent, of course, some transformative and fundamental changes in the world order, which I don't see around the corner.
The violent suppressive effects of nuclear weapons a lot of your arguments are premised upon assumes an international security environment with two salient features: one, international anarchy; two, that nation states have a monopoly on the use of force within their territory. Trade and globalization and terrorism are eroding both of those fundamental premises. The kind of point that you just made about Iran and India is an example of that. So, two related questions. One, you know, when does this case study of the second half of the 20th century expire in its predictive power, given the trend lines of the threats and what mediates relationships between states, which is trade, really? And then secondly, if it is true that nuclear weapons still make major war unthinkable and, you know, bring sobriety to leadership, then why are you, you know, so concerned about our allies developing nuclear weapons? You know, Japan, South Korea, Turkey, et cetera, those are relatively stable governments and they're our friends. I mean, France and the UK, they have nuclear weapons. They have independent deterrence, and their acquisition of nuclear weapons certainly didn't damage those relationships.
I don't know when it expires. And I can't argue that it will stay in place forever. But I still think, frankly, I would argue that anarchy continues to be the dominant status, if you will, of the international system. I think states competing for power continues to be that. Now, clearly, the globalization trends and particularly the development of international terrorism has had an impact on that. But even international terrorists have to live on the land, breathe air, eat food, come from someplace, and oddly enough, they sort of need the support or at least tacit acquiescence of states. And so I'm in favor of more sovereignty, countries being able to control their territory better and to some degree helping countries, to the degree that's not an oxymoron, helping countries develop the capabilities to control that territory better. Why am I concerned about nuclear weapons in other states? I think that generally speaking, because of the pairing type relationships that might develop, in the case of Japan, for example, in the Far East, that this could create a more unstable situation. Japan has a history in the region that it's dealing with, having to deal with, and the cross-strait relations being what they are, relations between the two Koreas and Korea and Japan being what they are, not to mention the emergence of a very dominant China in the region. All of those, it seemed to me, are an example of that's a pairing that I think is better suited to the United States providing that capability. Now, at the end of the day, could you manage a situation like this? Well, we did. We did it in Europe. We managed a French nuclear program that we didn't want, that we were against. We persuaded the Germans not to have a nuclear program. But we did that by doing what? Deploying dual-capable nuclear weapons on German territory. Now, I'm not suggesting we need to go that far in the case of Japan, but we do need to think about what is it, you know, assurance is the flip side of deterrence, isn't it? It's getting into the psychological construct of your ally and making sure that they feel comfortable enough that they don't take those steps. And so I think on balance, I'd rather see a world with fewer nuclear states than many, although we may not have that choice in the end.
Well, I certainly agree. I'd rather have a world with fewer nuclear states than many, and that's the point. I mean, my sense is that you can't get there from here if the U.S. is not appearing to live up to a commitment that was at the core of the bargain, including to the allies we're deterring, that the nuclear order is supposed to tend towards disarmament. It's supposed to tend towards equity and the end of a double standard, which is what you get when no one has nuclear weapons. And I think it's highly less likely to have a world with fewer of these states if we're not seen to be doing as the president is suggesting of trying to get everybody to work with us to eliminate these weapons. And along that may fail, but at least if there's a clear commitment to the intention and not what it's perceived to be, which is that the U.S. is committed to retaining these weapons forever and therefore retaining a double standard, which it then is seen to want to enforce by using force on others, that produces a lot of resistance. Along the way, even with the president's agenda, we're going to be in this world that you talk about. We're going to be in the world with North Korea as it is. We're going to be in the world with Iran as it is. For now, we're going to have nuclear weapons. The states that have them are going to have them. We may go to war, but so seeking to abolish these weapons doesn't eliminate any of that. It doesn't change what we're going to do to these countries today, but if that's your intention and if people actually believe it, I think your leadership position is much stronger. But the whole insight there, I mean, it seems paradoxical, but the insight there is precisely that having more states with these weapons is less stable. And I'll tell you, there were two recent discussions, one with a German general, a retired general who'd been the head of the German army, who said, and he invoked Jessica's phrase, he said, since Westphalia, the defining characteristic of the state system was, the state has monopoly on violence, quoting a good German, Max Weber. And he says, and that works. He says, but what we have in the nuclear order right now is we have in the NPT system, we have five states claiming an oligopoly on the ultimate form of violence. He says that's not sustainable because the rest of the world states who say that they have a monopoly on violence realize that that can be trumped by what these five states have, and they won't accept it over time. The Indian former national security advisor, who really was the driving force in the Indian tests and the nuclear program, Vajpayee, a couple of weeks ago, said the same thing. He says, if there's not a commitment to disarmament, you will get proliferation. And if you say and insist that these are moral legitimate weapons, you lose the basis to say to others they can't have them. You have a treaty, that you can argue, but then he didn't say this, but I would argue, the U.S.-India deal undermines that argument because, we had rules that states like India didn't get nuclear cooperation, but we changed the rule because we wanted to. And so if you don't have a basis in some kind of moral or legitimate aspiration, it's very, very hard over time, again, over the long run, to ensure that you have less rather than more states with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think it's we need to have less senior participants in these debates so I get more willing to call time limits so we can.
Oh, no. Hey, I'd be easy if you would have said
no,
something.
No,
stopped.
I know.
That's like,
I
was just
Clark
waiting,
tried.
You know?
Clark tried every time.
I think that was unfair to George because you did not throw the red flag. Throw the red flag.
Yeah. Be tough. Come on.
And I was too long, too, in my response, wasn't I?
I think we have a few minutes. We have a few minutes for audience Q&A, and I think Chris is going to select. He already has.
Thanks. I'm going to stand up. Bill Taylor from CSIS. Great debate. We're way ahead of this thing. We're getting to the issues. For either Juan or Jess, in the debate, we've been talking a lot about rational actor models. How do you handle the argument because it'll come eventually, that an argument based on something like John Stessinger's work, Why Nations Go to War, he came to the conclusion, a lot of case studies, historically, more often than not, wars are started by accident or miscalculation at times of high tension. Which side uses that argument, and how do you handle it? We're talking about an argument, and we're talking about evidence in a debate. Is it a good argument or not?
I think both of us can use it in a funny sort of way. I mean, I don't know that I accept Stessinger's premise. Okay, I will start there. I admit that wars can start by miscalculation and accident. I'm not sure it's the dominant feature, and of course historians debate the origins of even the First World War today. Was it miscalculation? Was it German war aims? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's difficult to unwind those things, I think. I think from my standpoint, though, it is one of the reasons why I think that in a world in which there's a lower number, presumably, of nuclear weapons, but that we have not gone to a world of abolition, the risks. Nuclear weapons have a way of making rational actors more rational and irrational actors maybe a little bit more rational. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't have irrationality. And as I admitted to George, I can't predict that there won't ever be another one of the use of one of these in anger or potentially accidentally, although I think that prospect is much less likely in terms of the responsible nuclear states. I do see a really important role for those states as the NPT regime states to put pressure on those that I think are less likely to have responsible nuclear programs. I'll let him talk about the way he can use the argument.
Well, I'm kind of with JD. I mean, it's a great question. It's kind of hard to do, you know, off the top of the head. But my first reaction was that JD, I could see it both ways. But here's what I thought. For irrational actors, by definition, we would say nuclear deterrence then wouldn't operate because they're not rationally calculating. I'm not sure I believe it, but that would be the axiom. But then you could argue, well, they may be irrational, but nuclear weapons are so different they can rationalize the irrational actors, like therapy. All of a sudden, they get nuclear therapy and they become rational, in which case it would work. There's another, I have another problem with the premise, which I don't know if that's a dodge, but usually you're not dealing with single actors. I mean, usually there's groups. I mean, and one of the best reads ever for me was the Cuban Missile Crisis tapes, and reading that discussion of the different, you know, and Kennedy's always the one that kind of is going, wait a minute. But he's getting lots of different advice. And I know in the Indian case, there are multiple actors. I know in the Pakistani case, there are multiple actors. I know in the Iranian case, there are multiple. I mean, so I don't know North Korea. But and so the argument would be, yeah, you might have an irrational actor, but there's somebody there who would be trying to inject rationality. That, it seems to me, would be an argument, at least on its face, maybe for nuclear weapons as a special source of caution. But then you get into the whole other issue of, wait a minute, the argument, rational argument, then becomes go first. Because look, there's a lot of people in this room, who've spent careers and developed the argument operationally of the rational thing is to go first. So where does that get you? You get the stability-instability paradox, and that did operate in Pakistan, for example. You say, well, precisely because they have nuclear weapons, if we jab them a little bit, they won't escalate. So deterrence is actually going to give us a better cover for going to war with them, long as it's not too much. This is precisely the Israeli worry and our worry about Iran with nuclear weapons. It's not that the Ayatollah wakes up and says, let's nuke Israel. It's that, okay, you turn up the heat through Hezbollah and Islamic Jihad because the Israelis won't escalate. So I think when you start getting into it, the whole rationality, irrationality thing is difficult to see. I will close with something my father, which is like weird, said. He was a judge in Compton, which is a difficult part of L.A., And he said most of the murders that he, the cases that he tried when it was involved a handgun, he said it was always somebody who knew the other person. It was often a family. And it was always, he was convinced it was always because the gun was in the house. That if the gun hadn't been in the house, the murder wouldn't have happened. He wasn't a bleeding heart liberal. It was kind of his sense of empirical. So rationality, irrationality, my sense is, you know, the farther removed these things are from people, you know, in that scenario, the more assured I would be.
George, let me just ask, well, first let me make one comment, and that is I think that you shouldn't use the Kissinger example because he used nuclear weapons to end the 73 war in the Middle East. When the Russians stood down, he called a nuclear alert, and that was the end of that, and there was no more threat of Soviet intervention. So whatever his feelings are now, that's not a good example. But I do have a question about what would you do as the first three or four things to move in the direction you're talking about? Because it strikes me a little bit like Star Wars defenses, which everybody, it'd be great if we could put this big dome over the United States. It just it hasn't happened yet after tens of billions of dollars. Great to abolish nuclear weapons, maybe, but how would you get there?
Great question. And I'm kind of glad you brought it up about Kissinger because he used them more often than that. I mean, he was alerting these things a lot. But that doesn't take away his central point was they weren't usable and it didn't serve a rational policy objective. So it's in other words, it wasn't credible he was going to use them. It was especially when he did around Vietnam. Yeah, but on the first three or four things, and we can get a rip-roaring debate going here. I think in the near term, it's very important for the U.S. to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty for a variety of reasons that we could talk about, in many ways political in terms of building credibility to achieve the nonproliferation objectives or to begin to achieve those objectives that we want. To put pressure on India and Pakistan to sign the treaty and ratify the treaty because it doesn't go into force if the U.S. does it, but we need leverage there. That's like a near-term thing. I think what the president has said already is helpful in that direction. The big issues, it seems to me, are the fundamental strategic relationships between the U.S. and the U.S. and U.S. and Russia and the U.S. and China. That the whole process that the president's outlined and that we're talking stops very soon. If the U.S. and Russia don't get on the same page in terms of what their strategic relationship's going to be. It stops in terms of reductions. J.D. and Linton and others would know this better than I do, but it stops in terms of reductions. It's hard to imagine the Russians agreeing to go, you know, towards 1,000, let alone beyond that, if you don't get that relationship in a different order. And the same with China, that China's not going to stop building up, let alone kind of agree to enter a multilateral process to work down. If it doesn't have an understanding of where the U.S. is headed in terms of whether we'll accept their deterrent and mutual vulnerability, what we want to do with national missile defense, prompt global strikes, some other things that are very hard issues, those would have to be there has to be a lot more confidence in both our regard towards them and theirs towards us, or this stops. Because if you don't get China kind of on the same page, you don't get official material cut off, which means you don't get the kind of monitoring and other things we need to move in this direction. You probably don't get the CTBT. So the whole thing kind of stops very soon without real changes in the U.S.-Russia, U.S.-China relationship. And I don't know how that'll turn out, but it strikes me that having that objective and going to them and proposing that they engage on this with us is first of all, harmless, and secondly, useful, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
My name is David Kanegi, and I work at the Department of State. Usually when we talk about, or when you guys talk about nuclear weapons, we always say that there was the before nuclear weapons and there was a great paradigm shift after nuclear weapons. And I sort of wonder if there's been another one, and that's with all the smart weapons and just high-tech conventional weaponry we have. So would a rogue state be more likely to want nuclear weapons to deter the use of those conventional weapons? I mean, they could build a nuclear weapon, but they can't build laser-guided.
Who are you asking that to?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll respond and George can respond. I mean, I think among the reasons, I would say, that a rogue state might want to have a nuclear capability is to balance advanced, superior conventional military capabilities, to offset them. Now, I say rogue state there because, and I realize that's a term that's currently out of fashion, but the point is that however you want to define it, there are a lot of states around the world who are not going to seek nuclear weapons simply because the United States has precision-guided munitions, right? Because they don't have an agenda or a desire to either become regional hegemons, to place themselves in opposition to the United States, where they may feel that they could be the subject of U.S. interest in that respect. And some states, for example, Libya made a very interesting calculation to go in the other direction, which was based on the concern that I think largely not a concern about American nuclear weapons, but a concern about American conventional prowess. They decided to get rid of their weapons of mass destruction programs. But having said that, yes, I think clearly that even if the United States got rid of all of its nuclear weapons unilaterally, Iran would still be concerned, given its interests, about American conventional military prowess and would probably still want to have a nuclear weapons program. It's part of the argument. Yeah, I think it gets into the prompt global strike, and you've got a chapter, maybe. Yeah, okay, right.
the lovely Carol Merrill is on. Well, I agree with JD. I just want to add a couple of things. Right. I think there's an interest in deterrence of invasion in whatever form that takes. There's a flip side to it, and I pose this as a historical question. I think I have the answer, but I'm not sure. Which is, I think no state has taken and or held territory after it acquired nuclear weapons. In other words, the point I'm trying to make is these have not been historically, and I would argue they're not going to be offensive weapons or weapons that you use to then blackmail and take territory and hold it. They're deterrent weapons. They keep people from taking your stuff and invading you. And I think that's the motivation, you know, for Iran's least desiring of the option. And I think that was Pakistan's motivation. You get other things with it, which is partly due to our mistake. You know, you kind of inflate the prestige with it. But the historical question for historians is, has anybody actually used nuclear weapons for territorial aggrandizement in the past or successful offensive blackmail? I don't think it's the case.
Tom Tierney has been itching to get a question in, so...
Dr. Berkovich, you said the actual know-how can be a deterrent. So my question to both of you is, would a latent nuclear weapons production capability satisfy the requirements for abolition? And then second, zero is not quite verifiable. So under what conditions can the U.S. adopt abolition without verification?
Well, you can define abolition any way you want, right? I mean, we have a comprehensive test ban treaty that allows for certain kinds of. Actually, there are numerous interpretations of that treaty that allow for different outcomes in terms of what you can do. We had an ABM treaty that permitted, we think, different ways of doing research and development and testing under the ABM treaty. So So we can design an abolition regime that allows for that. We may well end up with one that's ambiguously negotiated, so that one group of people thinks they can do one thing, and another group of people can think they can do another. And then there's the possibility. I know it hasn't happened since yesterday, but people could cheat on agreements. So, you know, there all those things are possibilities. I mean, we what we'd want to live with, I would argue, in a world of very low but certainly no nuclear weapons, and I tend to think the United States follows these agreements more scrupulously than others, we would want a very high standard in terms of verification. It's the reason I made the argument that I didn't think we could get there.
I think I just want to follow up and not disagree with JD, but follow up. I think he's right about how you would design it in many ways. What I was trying to say is at least at some point this latency would be a fact, whether it was designed or not. So you just have to manage it because the know-how would be there. And so on the verification issue, and my colleague James Acton, who's here and who co-wrote these things with me, has done a lot of work on the verification. And what we argue there is you can do a lot with verification, but especially the farther down you go, the more inherent uncertainties there are, especially with the U.S. and Russia, where there are enormous uncertainties in the amount of fissile material produced. The uncertainties get strategically less significant with the smaller states. But you would have to have layers of in a sense, confidence building that's a lot like what happened with South Africa when South Africa disarmed. I mean, it announced that it had dismantled these weapons. Nobody saw them because they dismantled it first. The IAEA comes in and does an inventory and checks all the records and stuff. But there's still an uncertainty over how much was produced. So you interview all the people involved in the program, and you do it like, you know, forensics interviews almost, although it'd be more friendly if there were agreements on this, to make sure the stories add up. And then with South Africa, again, there's some uncertainty, but you look at the political relationship and the nature of the state and everything else, and you say, okay, we can live with it. That will be harder, obviously, with the states that we're talking about, at least as far as you can foresee. But the argument we make is the case shouldn't rest on verification. You can do more on verification to give yourself confidence, but the heavy weight has to go on enforcement, just for the reasons that J.D. said. The question that the U.S. and others would ask, okay, fine, we're going to have all this verification, but what are we going to do if someone breaks out or because there's inherent uncertainty, what's the mechanism for authorizing responses, including potentially the use of force? And that's the part that people don't like to talk about, but that which we're saying, you know, we actually really have to start getting at the enforcement question, because I think people don't like to talk about it because it's not so technical. It's nice to think there's technical solutions to all this. Well, you get a new gadget to verify the thing, and, you know, it'll be fine. But JD's pointing out, and we have lots of experience where ambiguities, and you need to know what the enforcement mechanism is.
All right. I want to thank our guests here for a very stimulating debate.